Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. About half of addiction aid organizations nationwide reported having to decrease services on account of COVID-19. That's according to a new survey from New York University. If cutbacks and closures continue, it could mean the spread of diseases like HIV and hepatitis if clients are not able to exchange their syringes. These organizations also typically provide medical and life-saving services like Narcan. I want to welcome Scott Fletcher to the show. He's executive director of the Community Action Place in Murfreesboro. Among other services, the organization provides free HIV and STI testing, overdose prevention training, and needle exchanges for Southern Illinois. Scott, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brian. It's good to be with you.
And we're also joined by Casey Toner from Chicago, where he's been reporting on this topic for the Better Government Association. Casey, good to have you back on the 21st.
Thanks for having me on, Brian.
Scott, I want to start with you. What role does the Community Action Place serve for your communities? What sort of services do you offer?
So, Brian, we actually provide syringe exchange, syringe services for the southern 19 counties of Illinois. We have about 400 participants in our program, and we provide not only clean syringes, cottons, cookers, sharps containers so that we can get the dirty syringes properly disposed of, but we also provide HIV testing, hepatitis C testing, and syphilis testing for participants in our program.
And how many people use those services? I understand that the Community Action Place is one of, or if not the only, full-time needle exchange south of Champaign.
We are. We have about 400 participants in our program. We deliver about 90 participants every week.
Okay. And what have the past few months under the stay-at-home order been like for you and your organization? I gather you're still open, but you've had to adjust your operations somewhat?
So we've had to adjust our operations in that we have had to revisit our policies, especially as they relate to protecting our staff, making sure that we are social distancing, as well as having personal protective equipment when we deliver services. That's really been a challenge because our participants want to see the face of the people that are visiting them to deliver syringes. They want to know, you know, that they've gotten used to it now. In the beginning, we just social distanced, kept 6 feet apart, made sure that, you know, we were maintaining that distance with the participants, and then we kind of eased into the PPE so that people were given a little bit of advance notice of what we were going to be doing. We didn't want to take anybody by surprise. We've had to adjust a little bit with respect to the way we are, the amount of clean syringes that we are providing. Not knowing exactly what was coming next, we started the stay-at-home order time period with providing double the number of syringes that we had been providing in the past, letting people know, you know, we don't know where this is going. We're trying to make sure that you've got clean syringes. You know, we want to make sure that they stay safe and protected, and that we can possibly reduce the spread of HIV, hepatitis C, and syphilis among the population.
I think it's interesting. Most people, I think, might think of a needle exchange as a place where people have to go to get a service, but you do house calls. Is that because of the rural nature of the area you serve, or?
We do. We actually are, our model is we do have a drop-in center in Marion, Illinois. They can also, we have some fixed sites where they can come and pick up syringes as well. But one of the things that we have noted, especially in Southern Illinois, is that the rurality has a huge impact on people's ability to get to, you know, let's say they live out in the country in Elkville, Illinois. It's hard for them to get to Carbondale. We don't have a great transportation system that works for all of our communities. So we took the approach of very early on of making sure that we were meeting them where they needed us to meet them. So we usually, most of our new participants, we will meet at a public location, a Walmart parking lot or something of that nature. And then they ease into us showing up at their house. And we actually do outreach to some of the drug using houses, trap houses. We actually will deliver to those as well. And those are, you know, that actually gives us a lot of buy-in from people in the community with respect to the people who use injection drug community. They appreciate the fact that we reach out, that we meet them where they're at, and we don't judge them for any of their behaviors.
If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Scott Fletcher. He's executive director of the Community Action Place in Murfreesboro. We also have Casey Toner with us from Chicago. He's a reporter at the Better Government Association. Casey, in your recent reporting, you looked at different addiction aid organizations in Chicago. I wonder if what Scott is saying echoes what you've been seeing in the city.
Chicago is a little bit different. The models are a little bit different, and the density is very different. You know, the Chicago scene serves about 10,000 heroin users, needle injection users specifically, in the Chicagoland area a year. And combined, they distribute a little more than 4 million needles a year. And there's two organizations. One of them does mobile delivery and drop-off primarily. Another organization, which is affiliated with the University of Illinois Chicago, has storefront operations, throughout, the west sides and the south side, and they have a north side location as well. And, you know, what we reported in our story is that they have, to varying extents, reduced some of their services, and, the people that they typically serve, just aren't there. And I spent the most time with COIP, which operates the storefronts, and they've shut down a couple of their storefront sites. And I went to one of them, and I kind of watched what they were doing, and I spoke to people that came there about what their lives were like. But the storefront organization said that they had the number of needles that they exchanged had fallen from 24,000 in March of 2019 to 5,000 in March of 2020. So they've seen a huge drop off in the first month, that the lockdown order really went into effect.
So you mentioned COIP. I gather that's the Community Outreach Intervention Project. And as you say, Casey, the amount of needles exchanged has plummeted compared with this time in previous years. What does that mean for people who use these services typically?
Well, we spoke to several users who, were kind of giving us the, their impressions when we told them. And they basically said that it's not everyone, certainly, but there, is a population of high-risk users that will share. When you share needles that can, low needles, you share them, that can spread hepatitis C and HIV. We also spoke to a young man who said that he was running low on his needles because one of the storefronts closed down. And so a buddy of his told him some, method where he could try to sharpen one of his old ones with a nail file. And he said that, it felt terrible when, he tried to use it. So these shutdowns and, the scaling back of services do have, an impact on people's lives and on public health.
And I guess if people are sharing, then that means potential more spread of HIV or hepatitis, things like that.
Yes. And, we mentioned in our story, there was a very famous case in Indiana that had a prohibition on needle exchanges. And because of that, there was an HIV outbreak that infected more than 100 people. And, you know, the state ban on needle exchanges played into it. And then Governor Mike Pence kind of slow walked, rescinding the prohibition, which, you know, kind of made everything worse. So, you know, time and time again, you know, needle exchanges have shown to, you know, really, you know, prevent outbreaks of deadly disease. And, you know, right now, I think another, you know, great thing that they're doing is that, you know, they can also help identify potential COVID cases, because, you know, people who are using heroin have a harder time sheltering in place. And they're often, in Chicago at least, they're often congregating, you know, with other people who also have a hard time sheltering in place. And when people go to these storefronts or they go to the vans, you know, they can, you know, potentially get flagged as, you know, exhibiting some symptoms and then, you know, be sent to a public health provider. And I think this is also really important too, because, you know, in the city, many of these folks rely on public transportation, you know, so it is not just, you know, users spreading this deadly disease amongst themselves, but, you know, to the greater population at whole. And I think that's a really big thing to think about when you're thinking about public health in a pandemic and infectious disease, is that it can be spread outside of, you know, these high-risk groups.
Casey, I want to play a clip from your reporting. This is University of Illinois Chicago health specialist Stockton Mayer, who has been working with the Community Outreach Intervention Project in Chicago and doing testings of homeless encampments and other sites.
For our clients here at the Needle Exchange, we're really concerned about, you know, what happens to them when they get COVID. One of the biggest issues that we faced, I think, when we first started kind of addressing this with our clients was, you know, if someone comes in positive symptoms, where do they isolate? Because a lot of our folks are experiencing homelessness every day. So, you know, where do they go to isolate if they can't go home? What happens if someone's positive and you've got opioid use disorder? You know, how are they quarantined effectively or isolated effectively? And how is their opioid use disorder treated?
So, Scott, I want to bring you back into the conversation, because aside from the potential health consequences from fewer clean needles, as some addiction aid organizations have had to close or scale back, I mean, that is obviously not the only health issue at play here, as we just heard in the clip. And Casey was mentioning these communities are dealing with the spread of COVID-19. We've only got a few minutes left in our conversation, Scott, but can you talk about how those things are affecting each other in your part of the state?
Sure. So one of the things that we are doing is we are screening our program participants for COVID. When we see them, we are then referring them to the COVID hotline. And we have had participants that have actually been able to get plugged into care. We have, and I noted that Casey brought up, that, you know, that one of the big issues is opioid use disorder. And we do have about 40% of our participants are opioid users. However, we have a large percentage of our user population that is actually using injection methamphetamine. So for us, you know, we are trying to make sure that our opioid users are plugged into not only getting screened for COVID, but we also want to make sure that they are that we have a mechanism to get them into supportive care for their opioid use disorder while being treated or quarantined.
Okay. And there is so much more I think we could talk about this story, but I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Scott Fletcher, Executive Director of the Community Action Place in Murfreesboro. And we also have been talking to Casey Toner. He's a reporter with the Better Government Association. And we will tweet out a link to Casey's reporting on this topic. There's a lot, like I said, a lot more we didn't get to in the show today. Scott, Casey, thanks so much for speaking with us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Brian.
And that is all the time we have for today. As always, you can keep up with our show on Twitter, as I just mentioned. We are at 21ST Show. That's 21st Show. We tweet out links and analysis about what we've been talking about, but also encourage you to sign up for our podcast. You can find us pretty much anywhere you get podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.